closing Genesis anyway, but it kind of does fit Memorial Day. Call it Israelite Memorial Day. The last part of Genesis will be the end of Jacob and the end of Joseph, and they're thinking about memorials. So in some ways, that would not be a happy message, but it kind of fits today as we think about those that have passed. And the original readers would think about the founding fathers of Israel. 2 weeks ago, we looked at Jacob blessing his sons. None of them were cursed. All were still in the family. Some did not get what they fully would have had, had they lived different lives. And Genesis 39 closes after he's talked with them all. So please come to Genesis 49, and we'll look at the last section there. And here he's going to request, don't bury me in Egypt, bury me back in the promised land. Genesis 49, verse 28. All these, the sons mentioned previously, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what the father said to them, and he blessed them. He blessed them, everyone with a blessing appropriate to him. Then he charged them and said, I'm about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham had bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. And in verse 31, here's all the previous generations. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah. There they buried Leah. The field and the cave in it that is in it, purchased from the sons of Heth. And then Jacob finished charging his sons. He drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. We come to mind, set your house in order, will not come into Bible until Isaiah 38, so it wasn't written yet, but that's kind of what Jacob is doing here. He previously had blessed all the sons. A couple of grandsons were kind of adopted up into the line, get the same inheritance as the sons. Reuben had not behaved. He was like water, and again we would say he was like a drip. He wasn't stable, so his dad didn't curse him. He's still part of the family, but he missed out on the leadership that he could have had being the firstborn. Special blessings to Judah and to Joseph. The Messiah would come from Judah. And it narrows down some more in following Old Testament books, that he would come from Judah. And the time would be as when the scepter departed from Judah, the Messiah would already be here. That was interpreted that when the Roman government took away the right of capital punishment from the Judean law courts, they thought that was the fulfillment of Genesis 49. And the rabbis can be quoted at the time that the power of the law courts had been taken away from Judah. And the actual quote says, woe to us, the Messiah has not yet come, but the Messiah was already there. And they just didn't look for him. And the law court power was taken away, the scepter was taken away. That's why they had to go to Pilate to ask for a capital punishment. They did not have the authority any longer. And that time in the Old Testament would be the time when the Messiah would already be here. So he was already here, and that's the fulfillment. The deliverer is coming. He wanted to be buried in Machpelah. Now, it's an older city name here. We'd know it as Hebron. I remember visiting Israel, and we kind of wanted to go to Hebron. And he said, we can go back and get a bulletproof bus, and then we can go. And then we said, let's not go. But there is a monument in Hebron, a building. It has the same stones in it as in the temple, which means it's from the period of Herod the Great, when Jesus was born. It's a 2,000-year-old monument. Not all the way back to Abraham, but all the way back to Jesus is where they thought. Here is where Abram and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob were buried. I think I said it last time, but when Israel could do so, they sent a really thin girl soldier down into there with cameras. It is a burial spot. There are burials in there. If it were safe, they probably would bring them up and exhume them and probably display them. Here's what's left of Abraham. But it would cause World War III to do so. So what we know now is there's a 2,000-year-old monument on this place, mentioned right here. And it is a funeral place. There are remains in it. And it probably is the people that are named here. So he said, don't bury me here, bury me in the promised land. And what that means is he believed the promises that had been earlier given to Abraham. In Genesis 19, there was a prophecy that your descendants will go into a strange land for 400 years. But then the people will be punished. We would interpret now as Egypt will be punished. And the people will be delivered and will go back to the promised land. So Jacob believes that. Joseph would believe that. They believe that the fulfillment was they would be in Egypt for 400 years. They would go away. And then Jacob, he wants to be buried in the promised land. We should probably, again, before we leave, look at the phrase, gathered to his people. It's in here twice, but one's at the close of verse 33. He breathed his last and was gathered to his people. I'd have to research some more, but theologically, death is separation. Physical death in the Bible is very often to the end of breathing. We might look at it now as the end of heartbeats, but very, very often the breath goes out, and that is described as a time of death here in the Bible. Breath equals spirit. It's the same word in both Hebrew and Greek. Holy Spirit's like holy breathing. And the definition would be breathed his last, he's gone. Gathered to his people. Well, one might think of burial, but as we read the story, he won't be buried for a long time. In the moment he died, he was gathered to his people, which talks about the life after death and the intermediate state. He's going to go see his relatives. The New Testament does stress seeing Jesus for believers. 2 Corinthians 5:8, absent from the body, present with the Lord. Philippians 1:23, to depart, be with Christ, which is far better. It stresses seeing him. When Stephen was stoned, he could see the Son of Man standing. Now, everywhere else he's sitting at the right hand of God ruling, but evidently when a believer comes home, he stands to greet them. Assuming that what happened with Stephen when he's stoned is what happens to everybody. So there's life after death, and usually the stress is on seeing Jesus, but we see other relatives who were believers. In Hebrews 11 and 12, it gives the heroes of the faith, and it says they are a cloud of witnesses watching us run the race and keeping our eyes on Jesus. Now, he's the main person at the finish line, but there are others that are watching. I think from time to time, the departed hear about what's going on. And I don't see how it could be heaven to be watching us all the time. I don't see how that would be heaven. But whenever someone leaves, they give new reports, so they kind of know what's going on. And Jacob has been thinking about his departed family, and that's what he's thinking about here, and he wants to be buried with them. So gathered to his people, we refer to going to them at the time of death, and then later we're getting ready for his burial. Let's read chapter 50, verses 1 through 3. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. That's a personal name still. He wrestled with the angel, and Jacob was called Israel. Now 40 days were required for it, for such is the period required for embalming, and the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. Well, we would say, aren't funeral directors and doctors two different professions? Yeah, they were in Egypt too. They weren't the same. And so Joseph was deliberately telling the physicians, you getting ready for the funeral. And what he was avoiding is the pagan priests. They would have been the funeral directors. He's avoiding the pagan priests. He doesn't want them around. He doesn't want their rituals. He doesn't want their incantations at the deathbed. So in his time, he wanted the physicians, who evidently knew how to do it too, you do it, but we'll keep the pagan priests out of it. There are times when following a cultural thing is not a matter of theology or ethics. It was all right for Joseph to wear Egyptian clothes. He chose that. It's not a right and wrong matter. Joseph, like Egyptians, would shave. I would assume his dad and his brothers did not. That's a cultural matter. It does not matter. But regarding religious union, regarding bringing in the pagan priests to do rituals over his dad's death, he didn't want anything to do with that. We can be friends with people in false religions. It's all right to be friends with co-workers and all right to be friends with neighbors, but that's a little bit different than, say, joint so-called worship. It is all right if we are friends with people that are Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims or atheists and do what we can to influence them. That's okay. It's a little bit different than having them participate in the worship service or having them be the same. And Joseph did not want these sorcerers and pagan priests being a part of it. It is interesting that his in-laws would have been pagan priests. And when he was married to his father-in-law would have been a priest, if still alive. If not, his brothers-in-law would still be priests. He didn't want anything to do with that. So he picked names, Hebrew names for his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And when the time came for his ceremony, he had nothing to do with it. I will say we can tell from 70 days of mourning that that's... that in Egypt would be, you know, like a vice president. We have a 21-gun salute, and then we have a 19-gun salute, and they would mourn 72 days for a pharaoh. Next level is 70. So that's the way, that's their culture. And in other words, Joseph is like high on the list. Now they're getting him ready for burial by the Egyptian ways of doing it, and let's read on, getting ready to take him. When the days of mourning for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I'm about to die in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now therefore, please let me go up, bury my father, then I will return. Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father as he made you swear. So Joseph went to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of the household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt. And all the household of Joseph and his brothers and his father's household, they left only their little ones and their flocks and their herds in the land of Goshen. They also went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which was beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentations. And he observed 7 days mourning for his father. Now when the Canaanites of the land, inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atah, they said, this is grievous mourning for the Egyptians. Therefore it was named Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he had charged them. And his sons carried him in the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham had bought along with a field for the burial site from Ephron the Hittite. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt and his brothers, and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. Well, I didn't say it loud in any other word, but it's up, 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 up. In the Bible, going to Israel is always up. Going to Jerusalem is always up. In their way of writing and thinking, every place else is down, going up. They still talk that way. If you move to Israel, you're going up. They still talk that way now. That's kind of the attitude and the feeling about it. Kind of a special place. He wanted non-moral practice. Go ahead and put him in a mummy. Go ahead and make a coffin. But he wanted to be buried in the promised land. He believed the promise in Genesis 15. Joseph wept. Well, that's just fine. Death is separation. Separation hurts. As long as you remember the phrase, sorrow not as others who have no hope. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13. Sorrow makes sense. Separation is bad, but not hopeless sorrowing. So they go up and they go to a place called Abel Mizraim. It's not a Hebrew lesson. That is the word for Egypt. Mizraim, we use Greek, Egypt. They would call themselves the land of Mizraim. Their airline is Mizraim right now. That's the word they would use, and we wouldn't use it every day, but it's right here. So they believe the story that they're going to go out from the land after 400 years. And Jacob wants to be buried with his previous generations, and he wants to go now. We probably would miss this, but the original readers would be very interested in the trip. How did they get to Israel? They did not go up the seacoast through Gaza. And that's very common in the Bible. They avoided it. They didn't go up the seacoast. They didn't go up through Gaza. They went the long way, and then they came and crossed the Jordan. So that's the trip that's being, that's why so many of our songs will have crossing over, and that's why we're going to end on Jordan's stony banks. But Joseph took them the long way and crossed the Jordan. And when Moses wrote this book 400 years later, they're going to remember they have the bones of Joseph with them, and they're going to go the long way, and they're going to cross the Jordan. So the trip was designed, take Jacob, bury him, cross the Jordan. 400 years later, Moses comes along, takes the bones of Joseph, goes the long way, cross the Jordan. It's done on purpose, and this is what the original readers are going to be thinking about, that they're going to where their ancestors have been buried. They're going to the promised land. 70 days of mourning. I don't know how long it takes to come up with some recovery. This was the Egyptian style. I think they had paid mourners, people who would cry and lament and play instruments. I've heard them in Israel, and they're kind of weird. I've heard them on a temple wall playing their mourning songs. Well, we feel sorry for anybody who loses anyone, but the participants don't grieve as much as the family. Some of it is good manners. How long would it take? I think that's individual. And then it went this direction because I do think Americans tend not to take long enough. I don't know if we need to take 70 days, but I think we tend to, when we lose somebody, it's a big long do list. Get this trip going, make this arrangements, you know, take care of the government and Social Security, do all the other stuff. And it's like a long do list for a while, and then a few days later, it's over with, and then it hits. I think that we don't pay attention at the time, maybe as much as we should. And it might take a little longer. I know it'll take 70 days, but it might take a little longer, and that is all right. There's nothing wrong with it, with feeling bad and having some grief for a little while after the ceremony is done. Maybe not as long as here, but maybe not as short as what Americans think, like get it over with and get back to work. Now, we've done the gathering for his people, and we've done grief for the funeral. Now the brothers are worried about the grudge. Let's read why they're worried about it, verses 15 through 19. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong she did to him?" So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father cried before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of God, your father.'" You remember that line. They say they believe in the true God. See it? "Forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place?" I kind of wonder if Joseph's brothers aren't lying again. Before Dad died, he told us that you need to forgive us. I'm not sure Jacob ever really said that. I would just have a question mark that the brothers are worried, and they are making up a story so that Joseph won't do anything. We might have some what is called projection here. Projection is placing upon others one's own feeling. I think the brothers' thought is they would have a very hard time forgiving anybody. If someone had thrown them in the pit, if someone had sold them into slavery, they would have a very hard time forgiving them. So they're kind of projecting, and they think that Joseph has withheld revenge just long enough to lose Dad, and after Dad is gone, then he will go back with revenge. So Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in God's place?" God is the one who gives ultimate judgment for wrong. Joseph had already told him he forgave them, and he's not going to go back and change his mind on that. Near the end of the book, we're actually getting to two of the great lessons from the Joseph story. One is forgiveness. The next one is the very next verse, that God will bring good out of evil. But verse 19 is forgiveness. Verse 20, God will bring good out of evil. Forgiveness, love covers a multitude of sins. I think the best thing to do with most things is to cover it up, move on, not worth bringing it up. Lots of things can be that way. And he's going to forgive them. He's going to cover them up. Let's go in the other direction, like we did last time. Love covers most sins. Then there are the top-tier crime-type things. And with crime-type things, that's the police and the courts. The worst, of course, is murder. were not under the law of Moses. So many of the infractions in the law of Moses did not carry over in the New Testament, but murder did. The death penalty for murder was way back in the days of Noah, Genesis 9, verse 6. And it was a part of the law, but it was pre-law, death penalty for murder. And repeated in the New Testament in Romans 13, where it says God ordained the government and they used the sword to stop evildoers. So I would say in both directions, love covers a multitude of sins. Most things let it go. In the crime tier of sins, then that's the police and court's responsibility. And I do believe in the death penalty for murder. The middle layer is like, it's too difficult to cover up. It's too difficult to just pass. On the other hand, it's not really a crime. It's not what a person would go to jail for. It's not a death penalty. Kind of a middle level thing. And one thought on this is holding a person accountable in some cases might be good for them. This is especially true with a young person, especially true with a person who might do it over and over again and get into real trouble unless they're held accountable. So love covers up most. Some are crimes, but then you have this other tier where really probably should not be covered over. Really should be, they should be held accountable. The actual definition of forgiveness is to drop accountability. And unforgiveness is to hold accountable. Now, modern Americans tie forgiveness and love together mostly, and they sort of do, but they're not really the same. God loves the world, but they're not forgiven to the believers. So love and forgiveness are not quite the same category. We should love even our enemies. And most of the time drop a lot of stuff, but there are times of holding them accountable. There are times when it's better to hold them accountable. We're supposed to in Ephesians chapter 4, let it go by the end of the night. And if something is really, really annoying and bad, and we can't let it go at the end of the night, the Bible does give the mid-level option of going to them in private, trying to reconcile. If they do, that's very good. If they don't, then at least we've done all that we could do in this life and have to turn it over to God. Sometimes there's such a thing as treating another person as a tax collector. That's the same account in Matthew 18, whereby we have tried and it doesn't work. Well, the Bible would say you tried. You don't have to try endlessly. Just once in a while, maybe, but you don't have to try endlessly. It's okay to withdraw. So with Joseph and his brothers, he didn't immediately cover it up. He was serious enough that he didn't immediately cover it up. He did not choose to use courts. He gave them a kind of probation, remember, and wanted to see how they were treating his dad and his brother. After that, he forgave them. And once a person is forgiven, we should not go back on it. His brothers would have. I think they're projecting here. His brothers would have, but he would not. He had forgiven them in the past. He dropped accountability. He always loved them. Forgiveness means dropping accountability. And so he would not go back, and he dropped all accountability. I think verse 20 is actually the key to learning the lesson. Let's read verses 20 and 21. For you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. Therefore, do not be afraid, for I will provide for you and your little ones. So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. We know Romans 8:28 better, but God uses, puts all things together for good to them that love God, and makes sense, that's more familiar. This is kind of the Old Testament Romans 8:28. You meant it for evil, but God turned it out for good. That means that God can take bad things and take bad things that are done to us, and he can bring good out of it. Of course, in Joseph's case, his brothers really, really mistreated him, but in the end, he ended up being prime minister of Egypt, and everybody can come there and avoid the famine. So God can use things that we don't understand. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, lean not your understanding. It doesn't have to make total sense, but in all his ways, he will direct our paths. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Now we can close out Genesis here, beginning at verse 22. Now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons, also the sons of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were born on Joseph's knees. I would say he kind of inherited his great-grandsons of Machir, and he took care of them. Verse 24, Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die, but God will sure take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you and shall carry my bones. You shall carry my bones up from here. So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. I think he inherited a couple of his great grandsons, and that's what that is about there in verse 23. He made them promise that someday, when they all left, they would take his bones. I find it interesting that 400 years later, Joshua took his bones and buried them in Shechem. And it says in the account of the Exodus that they were taking the bones of Joseph. What I think is fascinating is there was no Bible yet, and for 400 years they remembered. It's kind of like generation after generation after generation remembers an oral promise not written down, and they remembered it. So that when they carry the ark across the Jordan to attack Jericho, back in the line were the bones of Joseph. It's not stressed, it's mentioned, but they remembered a 400-year-old promise. Wow. It'd be like going back to a promise made to the pilgrims, and it's not written down. Everybody remembered, they remembered that he would be buried in Shechem. Joshua 24:32. When it says, I'll give you a double portion, the Hebrew word is Shechem, capital of the 10 northern tribes. And that's where Joseph is buried today. Well, we've done a long study of Genesis. It is the book of the beginnings. Isn't it good that it's not the end, because we get in a coffin at the end, a mummy. And in Genesis, we go from creation to curse to coffin. Good thing it's not the end. We go from creation to curse to coming to cross to crown. So Genesis is the beginning, not the end, but I think it helps us because we will know the rest of the Bible better for having studied creation, flood, and the origin of Israel. Let's pray together, please.